This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
If you're ready for a new job, let Express Employment Professionals help you. Express is already hiring for summer jobs in a variety of industries. Job seekers never pay a fee at Express. Go to ExpressPros.com to find your location. That's ExpressPros.com.
Nerds! Today's episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. Smart Travel doesn't just cover points and miles. They break down all the financial aspects of your trip, whether that's the best days to book, how to avoid hidden fees, or which fancy travel credit cards pay off, and which ones are just an expensive flex. If you want your travel budget to work harder, then dive into the best deals, products, services, and more with Smart Travel from NerdWallet, wherever you get your podcasts.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
A very good Sunday morning to you all. Welcome into WEEI. It is just after 10 o'clock here on Sunday, May the 4th, 2025. For all of the nerds out there, may the 4th be with you. Dan Ball with you. Thanks for being with us. Always great to listen to KJ Carson on my way in. So thank you to KJ for warming everybody up. And now you deal with me for the next couple hours. Leading into Red Sox baseball, game number 3, Red Sox and the Minnesota Twins. Pre-game coverage at 12:35 with first pitch at 1:35. Joe Weil will get you set on the pregame show. Then you got the duo of Will Fleming and Mike Monaco on the broadcast. And it's just dueling incredible announcer voices. I was listening to them yesterday driving around the area, and to hear one guy's incredible broadcast voice, like the kind of voice where you have one calling in life, and that's to be a broadcaster in Will, and then to hear Mike be like, well, you thought you have a good one, now listen to me do it. It's a great listen to hear those two guys together and them kind of jump off and entertain themselves. So that's all coming up later on today. Hello to those of you listening on some of our affiliates out in the Cape, Providence, Rhode Island, Springfield, Massachusetts, Worcester, Mass, Portland, Maine, Keene, New Hampshire, Claremont, New Hampshire, and White River Junction, Vermont. All of y'all can get involved in the conversation at 617-779-7937. That's how you call. That's how you text. We'll also chat with Joe Weil in the segment leading into the pregame show. As the Red Sox are very much first and foremost on my radar here on this Sunday morning. And before we get into all of that, I say hello and good morning to my man behind the glass, Brian Frazoco. Good morning, Brian. How are you?
How's it going, Dan?
It's going well. It's going well. Nice to have you here with us here on this Sunday. We'll have plenty of Celtics talk with Brian as well, because it's been proven time and again here on this Sunday show that he trumps my knowledge of basketball many times over. So we'll work that in as they get ready for their second round series. But let's begin with Tristan Casas and an injury that created a conversation amongst Red Sox fans and baseball fans that really fascinated me. So first of all, Brian, if you can cue up the call itself, if you missed it, this is what happens.
1-2, the pitch is a cue shot. Chopper on the first base line. Ryan bobbles, flips underhand, and Casas goes down in a heap, and he twisted his ankle through the bag. Tristan is in a ton of pain. He was smelling an infield hit. The right ankle and maybe knee rolled through the bag.
He just let out a yell, too. He is lying on his back. Alex Cora and the staff have come out. Casas is totally on his back. He made a lunge toward the bag to be safe after Ryan bobbled, and this is not looking good.
So that was the call from Will and Mike on Friday night. Bit of a Freudian slip there for Will to almost call him Twistin', because he thought he twisted his ankle on that one. This is a crazy sentence to say and mean it, but you wish it was a twisted ankle after we found out what the actual injury designation was. This is from Dr. Jesse Morse on Twitter. He says, first person, I am absolutely devastated for Tristan Casas right now. Awful would be an understatement. This is one of the most devastating injuries in all of orthopedics. The patellar tendon attaches the kneecap to the shin. We found out he ruptured it. It's most commonly partially or fully torn in offensive linemen in American football. There are two different versions, partial tear and full thickness tear. This is a gruesome surgery and an absolutely exhausting rehab. Despite that, unfortunately, the data post-surgery is quite poor, at least for elite athletes. Realistically, 1 year recovery, if not longer. Some players, most players, are never the same, especially with full thickness tears. The worst part is this is a completely fluky play. I can't even comprehend the mechanism to tear the patellar tendon falling like he did. Wishing him the best of luck in his long, arduous journey. And I think we learned in the matter of minutes when this took place on Friday that this went from, oh, this is bad, to, oh, this is devastatingly bad. Just to watch and then to listen to everything that took place. The fact that he was stretchered off, and then there were videos from fans that showed him being taken to the hospital via ambulance. Alex Cora confirms he was at the hospital, and he was in a bit of shock with what had gone on, because this is, at least from reading in my amateur medical knowledge and trying to poke around and figure out as much as I could and get as much information as I could, this thing's devastating. This is the kind of thing that may very well keep him out until late 2026, if not longer, if it is indeed as severe as everybody with more knowledge than myself is describing it. And it fascinated me. By the way, if you saw anybody that was in any way, shape, or form either making light of this, making fun of this in any way, and it was a very small minority on social media that I saw saying those kind of things, you are the lowest of the low. And I just had to get that out of the way, because it was bothering me that anybody in their mind would say anything other than, I feel terrible for the player, I feel even worse for the person, and I wish them nothing but the best. That is the only thing that should be uttered and should be thought in a situation like this. It comes after what has been one of the most fascinating and tumultuous off seasons for a player on the Boston Red Sox that I have seen in recent memory. And let's even take this back to the beginning of 2024, when Tristan Casas leaves a game last year, which, with what was described as the rib discomfort, the same thing that Christian Campbell was dealing with this year. And I say Christian Campbell because he is back in the lineup today. He's at second base. He's hitting cleanup. So luckily, at least for the time being, there's nothing wrong there. But he leaves with the discomfort, goes on the injured list, then he's down rehabbing, and then he kind of gets into the media, he said, she said, with Alex Cora, saying that it feels like I'm being stabbed by knives and I'm being shot with a gun, and that was all kind of captured in certain forms. Very interestingly, I was watching the way that players and Alex Cora reacted in the Clubhouse documentary on Netflix to all of this was also really interesting. But again, this is not making light of anything, just to lay out where this guy has come to, and it really kind of outlines just how devastating this is. So he has that extended stay, trying to get back, taking those, how did he call it, dry swings, the batless swings that he was, or the swings in his mind that he that
mental
he was
swings.
Mental swings, thank you. Yeah, the swings in his mind. He said, you know, I've taken a million mental swings. Awesome. Fired up for you. Ends up working his way back, and then that leads into an offseason of, will he get traded? Won't he get traded? He was mentioned in every single trade rumor that I can remember. He was connected to the Seattle Mariners multiple times. There was that crazy potential deal on the table that was Casas and Yoshida for Luis Castillo that apparently the Mariners turned down, which is also wild in its own right. But so to take this back from the second half of 2023, which was really when Casas arrived, statistically speaking, I believe it was OPS that he was a top 10 hitter in baseball in the second half, or at least a, you know, a top 20, top 30, a notable presence in the Red Sox lineup for that couple-month stretch after the All-Star break in 2023. It was the first time that we really saw the potential for this guy start to come out. And it had fans excited for what looked to be that middle-of-the-order, big-bopper first baseman that would lock down a position that had kind of been a revolving door for quite a while. I mean, the post Kevin Youkilis era, call it, and that's going from, that's including Adrian Gonzalez into Mike Napoli into Mitch Moreland into Steve Pierce into Bobby Dalbec into Tristan Casas. So there was finally a little bit of optimism of, oh, wow, this guy that's been highly touted through our minor league system is starting to discover his true elite big power bat talent. And you kind of forgive and overlook the fact that, you know, the defense at first base was never quite there. But it was there. And then 2024 is the lost year. All right, well, maybe he can find it in 2025. But it just kind of felt like 2025 was set off on the wrong foot by all of the proceedings that happened in the offseason in 2024. Trade rumors into the comments about the lineup that were made at the beginning of spring training. Here's where I'd play Bregman. Here's where I'd play Devers. And
not wanting to bring up any of the prospects.
Yeah. And Christian Campbell has been, for my money, the most consistent hitter on the Red Sox this year. I know Bregman's probably been the best, but I mean, Campbell has been on base all but like three or four games to start his major league career, making sure that everybody heard that loudly. So, again, offseason of trade rumors into 2025 spring training where unfortunately the comments were louder than the words were louder than the actions. Normally actions speak louder than words, but Casas had that flipped, poor guy, during spring training. And then you get to the regular season and it wasn't clicking. It wasn't clicking. Now, he had a .250 average over his previous seven games before the injury, 5 hits and 20 at bats. I know that's not world beating. He had a home run, couple RBIs mixed in there, but compared to how he started the season, that was progress. And you could tell that there was a bit of a difference in philosophy for how Casas normally goes about his at bats versus how the Red Sox were trying to get him to go about his at bats. He was patient as a strength, but patient to a fault in certain situations where he would see a pitch that he thought was a ball, and maybe if he had the ABS system and you could challenge it, maybe he would write. He was right. He had a very good eye, but it was almost too good for his own good, where he would see pitches that were borderline that would be called strikes, and then all of a sudden now you're down in the count, and you can't attack the way that his skill set would set himself up for. You can't really take those swings. You got to choke up. You got to try to, you know, hit for contact and not power, blah, blah, blah. All of it would lead to strikeouts. So it seemed like over the last week or two leading into Friday, it wasn't fixed, but it was getting fixed. And it was at least starting to look promising, major league caliber. Like, I think it seemed like it's two step forward and one step back, but it seemed like a little bit of progress is being made. And now we're here. And every conversation that was being had about the first base position for the Red Sox changes dramatically, because this is not a couple weeks. This is not a couple months. This is the remainder of the 2025 season, and very likely this is going to take you into the first couple months of 26, if not the All-Star break, just given the devastating nature it seems like this injury has. So all of a sudden, the first base position changes from, well, we're not sold on our guy, but we at least have our guy, to we have no guy. We have Romy, or as Will Fleming likes to call him, Romy, my homie. We have him. We have Abraham Toro, who was the call-up. And everybody was all, not everybody, that's painting too broadly. But I saw a swath of Red Sox fans bitching that, well, why are you calling up Abraham Toro? Don't you see what the two prospects are doing? And that's the best. Come on. We're talking about the first base position and a situation that has not been solved yet. You're not going to call up Roman Anthony or Marcelo Meyer to shoehorn them in at first base, guys that have not played first base in their professional careers. What Abraham Toro is a stopgap. He is a buy me some time to figure out what we do with this position for the long term. And I'm not even necessarily convinced that that long term is only a year. This could be, what are we doing at first base, full stop, depending on what the solution is and how the solution works compared to what you're getting from now another year lost worth of Tristan Casas' career. So it really is unfortunate. I know that there's been plenty of things that seem to be self-inflicted, but these are two really, really tough injuries in a two-year span that are seemingly going to limit what this guy is capable of. I mean, I'm playing doctor based on what I read on Twitter, but the recovery rate for this is not great. So even when he does get back to whatever the closest to full health he can be is, I don't know if that's 100%. I don't know what his new normal is going to be. So it seems like you're in a position where now you're buying some time with Romy, my homie, and Abraham Toro and everybody else you can throw there. I know Rob Refsnyder's played there a little bit, but again, that's not a solution. That's buying time to try to figure out what the solution is going to be. What is the solution at first base for the Boston Red Sox? We'll discuss that next. I heard KJ discussing it. I wanted to weigh in. We have some texts that are going to address that as well. And you can join the conversation on the conundrum that is Tristan Casas and what the Red Sox do next at first base. We'll get to all of that. Plus, later on in the program, the Bruins had their top head coaching candidate taken off the board, it seemed. We'll get to some of that. Celtics get ready for the Knicks. Patriots have kind of wrapped up all of their ongoing offseason moves, and the roster is night and day from where it was. So all of that will be on the table leading into Red Sox baseball here on this Sunday afternoon. But all of that is secondary because right now, Brian Frazocco tells you what's trending.
Now, here's what's trending on WEEI.
Here's what's trending on WEI and on WEI.com. The Red Sox dropped Game 2 of their three-game weekend set against the Minnesota Twins yesterday at Fenway Park. Game 3 of this series is today with first pitch at 1:35 on the Shaw's and Star Market WEI Red Sox Radio Network with Will Fleming and Mike Monaco on the call. Lou Maloney's guy, Garrett Crochet, will be on the bump for the Red Sox with Chris Paddock on the hill for the Twins. I've been telling you all day that the MassMutual pregame show is hosted by Dan Ball. Well, I was wrong. It will be hosted by Joe Weil. Denver Nuggets advance to the second round of the playoffs after beating the Clippers 120-101 yesterday in Game 7. They will now take on the Thunder in Round 2. And yes, James Harden has now lost a Game 7 with four different teams. The final game of the first round is tonight with the Golden State Warriors in Houston to take on the Rockets for Game 7. The winner will take on the Minnesota Timberwolves. The second round also tips off today with the Pacers in Cleveland to take on the Cavaliers. The Celtics kick off their second round series against the New York Knicks tomorrow with tip-off Game 1 at 7 o'clock from TD Garden. If you heard Justin Turpin earlier with us, he is predicting a sweep for Boston. In hockey news, the Dallas Stars took down the Avalanche in Game 7 last night behind a hat-trick from Mikko Rantanen. The final game of the quarterfinals for the NHL is tonight. With Jim Montgomery, the St. Louis Blues will be in Winnipeg to take on the Jets. The home team has won every game so far in that series. The NHL draft lottery is tomorrow night. The Bruins currently have the sixth highest odds to land the number one overall pick. And the Kentucky Derby took place yesterday with Sovereignty, who went into the race with 7-1 odds, taking home the trophy over betting favorite journalism. He finished in second. I'm Brian Frazocco. That's what's trending on WEI and on WEI.com.
WEI, WEI, New England Sports Original. Dan Ball on WEEI.
We don't take it for granted, you know. You guys don't take it for granted either, you know. Showing up to work every day and be a big leaguer. And he loves being a big leaguer. It sucks, to be honest with you. That's the part that you don't like about the job, right? When people get hurt and when you have to send people down, you know, it's pretty tough. Because, like I said before, they put so much effort and work in the offseason to try to play 162+. And then something like that happens, you know. And that's the reason we don't take it for granted, you know. You guys don't take it for granted either, you know. Showing up to work every day and be a big leaguer. And he loves being a big leaguer. He loves it. He loves to come to the ballpark at 10 in the morning and leave at midnight and do his thing, you know. And, you know, for now, I think it's going to be taken away. But like I said before, I told him he's going to be back at one point.
Red Sox manager Alex Cora waxing poetic about Tristan Casas, talking about the two things that he doesn't like as part of being manager, which is injuries and sending people down. He had to do both of those yesterday. So Tristan Casas on the 10-day injured list. Luis Guerrero also sent down to AAA Worcester. I guess his penalty was pitching well. I don't know. But Brandon Bernardino brought back from the bereavement list, and then Abraham Toro was brought back up. Today's lineup, in case you care, Duran, Rafaela, Abreu out in the outfield, then Bregman, David Hamilton at short, so no Trevor Story today. Christian Campbell back in the lineup at second base. He's hitting cleanup. And then Romy, my homie, Gonzalez at first base. Carlos Narvaez behind the plate. And Garrett Crochet. It's pig day on a Sunday at Fenway Park. And as Brian mentioned, Joe Weil will have the pregame. And then Will Fleming, Mike Monaco on the call. Game three, rubber game once again. It can't be a Red Sox series if you're not playing a rubber game in the final game of the series. 617-779-7937. If you want to join the conversation on Tristan Casas and what the Red Sox will do at first base. A text from the 860. That's why players take deals early on, and he declined. Okay. But this is one that jumped out from the 978. I agree. Personally, I'm not a Tristan Casas fan. However, this type of injury, quite possibly ending his career, is catastrophic, and it's a different level of compassion. Baseball is one thing. This is the man's livelihood, and that's the professional versus personal issue that comes up here. You are talking about the individual who has dedicated his life to baseball, and he's talked about that pretty much every chance he's gotten as he's been interviewed, and he was the centerpiece of the Clubhouse documentary talking about how much baseball means to him and what it meant to his family and his relationship with his dad and all that kind of stuff. So all of that is in play. Let's open up the phone lines. Bob is in Londonderry. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Well, very well. Enjoy the show. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. What do you got on first base for the Red Sox?
Well, you know, it's ironic that we really have learned nothing, meaning the Red Sox organization. Look what happened in 1986. You had a guy playing first, and like Wade Boggs said, you know, you got a cripple over there. What do you expect? We've learned nothing. You've heard Lou Maloney mentioned numerous times, get us a first baseman. Here we are, years and years later. We're now stuck with this guy. I would never have held my breath, injury or not. Not even worth the trouble that he's worth. And what they're going to do now is a good question, but we'll wait and see. That's just my opinion of the whole thing. Red Sox got their work cut out.
Yeah, no question, Bob. Thank you for the call. I went back during the break. Going back on opening day lineups for the Red Sox, your first baseman, let's start in 2023 because Casas has done it the last 3 years. Casas, Dahlbeck, Michael Chavis, Mitch Moreland, Hanley Ramirez, David Ortiz. They were at Philadelphia. Then Mike Napoli, Adrian Gonzalez, and then you got 5 years of Uke after Kevin Millar. So of all of the positions that you can look at, every position on the Red Sox has had at least some kind of consistency. You had Bogarts, you had Devers, you had Pedroia, the outfield has moved around a little bit, but at least you had Benintendi, Bradley, and Betts for a couple years together. But first base has been a revolving door, and this organization, for whatever reason, between Casas, Dahlbeck, Sam Travis, like they've had guys that have come up that have supposed to have been the answer at that position. It consistently, you haven't found the guy that's stuck. And every single guy that you mentioned has had flashes in the pan of being, oh, that's the guy. This is the guy that's finally going to solve the problem. Casas in 2023, Dahlbeck in 2020 or 2019. Again, that first year where you come up and go, oh, that's it. That's what everybody was talking about. That's what they saw. That's what we were waiting for. And then for some reason, it kind of flattens out. So that's all the past. And the past then informs the present, which is what the hell do you do next? So I heard the conversation that was going on with KJ before this, and it fascinated me. And so you're looking around the options that you have in the organization, and I guess you're probably starting to look external, I guess. Because the question becomes, are you trying to solve this problem for 2025, or are you trying to solve this problem, period?
Take a guess!
And that's all you can do at this point. Man, he is just a quote machine. Unbelievable.
In this in wide orbit over here, there's like a whole folder just of Mad Dog drops.
Just mix those in when you find
Absolutely.
Necessary. Point being, yes, we are taking a guess at this. So your current answer is Romy Gonzalez. who, I mean, has been pretty good in the role that he's played in terms of, I think he led Major League Baseball in pinch hit home runs and RBIs last year, or he was right near the top of that. So that is a very specific role that he's been playing. Are you now writing him in as your first baseman for the remainder of the season? I don't think that's the way you go. I think he's very valuable in the role that he plays. It's the same argument that you'd make for a guy like Rob Refsnyder. Unreal in fill-ins, pinch hits. Like, he's been a tremendous value add for the Red Sox since he got here. He's also become a bit of a veteran leader, which is also great. And it's, and all of that combines to the reason why he's still on the roster, and you've sent Masataka Yoshida to Siberia just for the sake of doing that. So I say all of that about those guys to say a Hamilton, a Romy Gonzalez, a Rob Refsnyder, all really good at what they do, which is be that bench presence, be that play once or twice a week, guy off the bench, matchup related pinch hits, all that kind of stuff. I don't want any one of the three of them in my lineup every single day, at least not yet. I would have to imagine that Romy Gonzalez is going to get, he's playing first again today, and he was starting to get a little bit more run. He played two out of the three games in Cleveland last weekend, and I would imagine that he's going to be the guy that gets a run. They'll at least give him a couple weeks to put up or shut up. What I like is that he is a tremendous athlete. You can tell that he's just a very good fielder in general. He brings more, and they were discussing this on the broadcast as well, brings more foot speed, brings more agility, is able to get to the bag quicker, make more agile plays. And as he plays more, just given the fact that he's a good infielder, it looks like he's the kind of guy that can grow more accustomed to the position. And you're already not really losing anything in terms of defensive deficiencies between Casas and having Romy in there. So he's your short-term stopgap. But I think it's fair to say that this was a problem before Casas got hurt, and now it's a problem with even less of a solution. So that's where Rafael Devers enters into the equation. And every Red Sox fan is going to turn to Toronto, the team that the Red Sox just saw, and go, well, they made it work with their third baseman who couldn't field at third. Why can't we? And I say to you, I agree. Now, it could be a disaster. It certainly could be a disaster. But, and especially since you just spent the entire offseason telling Devers he was your third baseman, just to sign Alex Bregman and pull him off of third base, just to now, a couple months into the season, Casas is hurt. Hey, we need you back in the field, and we're going to teach you a new position on the fly. Yes, Brian?
Does Devers strike you as the guy who's going to do what's best for the team, though? I mean, when Bregman was out, when he had the kid a few weeks ago, right?
Yep.
He had that great game in Tampa, and then his wife gave birth the next day, so he missed, I want to say, one or two games. And they didn't move Devers to third, right? I think Romy Gonzalez ended up filling into third base. To me, now again, we remember Cora at the beginning of the year saying, no matter what, Devers is going to DH. But to me, Devers doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who, if they were to come to him, whether it is to fill in a third base when Bregman's out, or to play first base, a different position, I don't think Devers is going to be the guy who's like, oh yeah, no problem, guys. I feel like he's going to be the kind of guy who's going to look at, oh yeah, that sucks. You guys don't have a third baseman? Oh, no one's playing first? That's too bad. Yeah, I was told I'm DHing. So, you know, that's, you guys should, you know, figure that out. But that's not going to be, like, I just... In theory, it's a good idea, and I think Devers has made sense at first base for a while now, just because, as we've talked about, they haven't had a first baseman in a while, and Devers kind of sucked in the field at third base, especially last year. So it's made sense from that aspect, but he hasn't struck me as the kind of guy who's going to willingly go over to first.
No, that's a good point, and I don't even think he's willingly playing DH right now. I think he's DHing because Alex Cora told him he's the DH, and despite saying no a million and one different times.
I mean, he did it very begrudgingly. He
you
know,
right.
You just talked about it. Like, he did an entire press conference just to say he wasn't moving to DH.
And then he went 0 for the month of March to, I don't know if it was protest or just because he couldn't get his head right. You're finally starting to make a little bit of progress. He looks happier. It looks like he's kind of at least made peace with what's going on. So, yeah, that side of it more than the physical ability. And, I mean, the physical ability is something that you have to discuss. The the weight of the individual and just the general physical makeup was a big conversation in spring training, and it continues to be. It continues to be because it's evident. The one thing about first base that you need, and Will Middlebrooks has talked about it, Lou Maloney has talked about it, like it's a much different animal than playing anywhere else in the infield. You don't have to use your arm that much. Like, the one thing that you have to be good at first base is be agile. You have to be light on your feet. You have to have good, clean footwork. You have to be able to run from your spot, get to the bag, set up, turn, and expect a, 70, 80, 90 mile an hour throw, whatever you're getting. And if it's at you, you get it right in the chest. Perfect. If it's not, you got to be able to move. You got to be able to stretch, and you have to be balanced, and you can't tear something when you try to stretch. And you have to keep your foot on the bag. Again, I know it takes half of infielding out because you don't have to worry about your arm. So theoretically, it takes half of Rafael Devers' league-leading error totals out of it because he doesn't have to throw the ball. But when I say agile and light on your feet, Rafael Devers is not the first player that comes to mind. I'm sorry, he's not. And you could give him a couple weeks to work on it, give him a month, and I'm sure that's what's going on here. It would be irresponsible of the Red Sox not to at least have him take infield, outfield at first base, give him a glove, see if there's anything there. See if there is anything, because if it's a disaster, then we just won't have this conversation, and he's your $3 million, $300 million DH. God, I wish it was $3 million. $300 million DH forever and ever, amen. But this is a weirdly opportunistic or a weirdly strong opportunity for the Red Sox to try this theory out and see if there's anything here. Because it's already a bit of a failure that he has not really progressed into the elite, consistent third baseman, power hitter, middle of the lineup presence, and leader of the Red Sox that you paid him for. But you could make a little more out of this situation than you have right now by at least seeing if he can play first base at a league average level. Because let's be honest, league average is what you've been striving for on defense for a couple of years now. So if you can at least get him to the level where he's not costing you runs. He's not screwing up the easy plays. He's not, dropping throws that were sent right between red and socks on the jersey. Then there's something there. So the Devers conversation is interesting. It also brings in Masataka Yoshida into the conversation again, because I am not convinced that there's anything wrong. He was throwing a football around in the outfield before first pitch either yesterday or Friday. So whatever's up with the shoulder, this guy that wasn't good enough to play left field or, throw a baseball ever, all of a sudden now his shoulder strength is the biggest injury concern of anybody not named Tristan Casas on the Red Sox. It brings him back into the conversation. I think a lot of fans would be intrigued by Rafael Devers at first and Masataka Yoshida as your designated hitter. That, to me, internally feels like the most palatable or intriguing option. The floor of this option is low. Like the bad Rafael Devers first base play and the Yoshida, whatever he ends up bringing, Yoshida rolling over to second every at bat like he did in the first half of last year. That's the floor. The ceiling in terms of how this rounds out your lineup is really intriguing. And if you can get that 260, 270 hitter, clutch hitter that Yoshida was in the second half of last year, and you at least get league average play on defense, I don't hate it. I really don't. All right, let's catch up with some of the text, and then we'll get to the calls as well on this. You hand the guy Kyle Schwarber. Yeah, that's true. Schwarber did not know how to play first base, and it was fine. But the one thing about the Schwarber comp, and this is what Brian brought up, and why I really do wish that he was still a member of the Boston Red Sox. Kyle Schwarber was an I will do whatever it takes kind of guy. Ultimate character guy. Ultimate clubhouse guy. This is on the record, off the record. Everybody who you talk to, Kyle Schwarber, my man, my main man. I did just watch Rain Man last night, so the whole who's on first conversation is still rattling around in my head. But he was the kind of guy that was going to play anywhere to try to make this team successful. So it's an interesting comp. Move Trevor Story to first base. Bring up Meyer. Nomar was eventually mentally at first base. This will save Story's shoulder and hopefully keep him injury-free and opens up a spot for the kid.
You told me this off the air, and you were a fan of this?
I'm intrigued by this, Brian. I really am. And there's a couple things that come into play. Taking Trevor Story away from shortstop, yes, that does take away from your defensive prowess up the middle, so to speak. He has been a nice – and he was also paid to be your shortstop, much like Rafael Devers was paid to be your third baseman. But if you're willing to move Devers, $300 million worth of him off, I'm intrigued by this because it's a fair point. And the texter that texted in before the show made the Ernie Banks comparison, which is the best comparison Trevor Story will ever get in his career being compared to Ernie Banks. At certain points, middle infielders, when they start to lose a step, sometimes they will transition to those corner infield spots. If you can't DH him, sometimes you throw him at third, you throw him at first. You take a little bit of the range away from them to try to just make it a bit easier for them to be productive and also not get hurt and not strain themselves. This is not an age-related thing, but I think the preserving Trevor Story conversation is an interesting one to have. And what I said a few moments ago about being agile, being quick on your feet, being good with a glove, being reliable over there, creating outs for your other infielders on throws or plays that maybe don't deserve to be outs, taking E5s, E6s, and E4s out of the book as a first baseman. I look at Trevor Story's skill set, and I think he might have that in him. It takes the pressure off of his throwing shoulder, which isn't necessarily a concern, but it certainly could be. We had conversations when he first got to Boston about throwing strength when he was playing second base in that weird year with Bogarts, where it was very clear that Bogarts was leaving, and so his replacement was kind of standing next to him over at second base. There have been a million and one different injury concerns with Story. So if you put him in a situation where he's a bit more secure, he's already a good infielder, I would trust his ability to pick up first base much more than I would trust Rafael Devers. Then you get to call up Marcelo Meyer, who was the International League Player of the Week last week, is really starting to tear the cover off the ball. And I hear all of that and I go, I'm intrigued by this. So that's a conversation to be had. What about moving Bregman to first and put Devers back at third? No.
I think that ship has sailed.
No. Nope. Again, I'm all for creative solutions. I would also trust Alex Bregman to pick up first base much more than I would trust Devers. But Alex Bregman is like a 320 hitter with a 1,000 OPS at third base for the Red Sox. Lifetime contract, blank check, by the way. I put that up on Twitter yesterday, and I fully stand by it. This is one of my, and Homer honk me all you want, Brian, but this is one of my favorite signings from the Red Sox I've ever seen in terms of on-field and off-field stuff. Like, I don't know what it is about the guy and how seamlessly he's fit in, but he already feels like a Red Sox, like the center of the Boston Red Sox. I love it. So that's the one thing I'm not touching, because I think he has earned the right and was signed for $40 million a year to be the third baseman of the Red Sox and the number three hitter. He's doing great at both. I'm not touching that. So who's playing first in AAA is another question from the 603. That was the 413, by the way, with the Bregman question. Not a bad question, just not the way that I would go out of the other options that we listed. Who's playing first at AAA? That's the problem, is that you do not have organizational depth at first base. You know who is playing first? Abraham Toro, and that's who's on the roster, who's also playing first, which is an option that I think that we should discuss, and we do have to take a break, is Vaughn Grissom. So you have Vaughn Grissom, who has only played like four or five games down at first base, but they're trying it. And then there's an option that my man Brian brought up when we were discussing this before our show today that I want to get to because it's unconventional, but when you look at the typical makeup of a first baseman in Major League Baseball, and I'll give you some comparisons, I think this one deserves more conversation than it's getting. Let's continue the first base conversation for the Red Sox, what they should do on the other side here on WEEI.
WEEI. WEEI. New England Sports Original. Dan Ball on WEEI.
Okay, the 1-0 is drilled high into center field, at the track, at the wall. Gone! His first big league homer. Christian Campbell ties it at 2 in Texas.
Will Fleming putting everything he has into a call that may have tipped Brian's hand on where he's going on this conversation with how to solve the first base conundrum that was already at least on the radar for the Red Sox, but now it's an outright problem. 617-779-7937, working backwards on the text line, 774, Bregman to first and bring Meyer up for third. No! Guys, we just solved this problem. Come on, let's leave well enough alone. Plenty other areas that you can focus on if you want to try to move somebody off a position. Just leave it. Stop. Don't. I feel like I'm talking to a kid. Don't touch it. Sit. Stay. All right. Move Yoshida the way they did Castillo. Both had big contracts. I'm assuming that's supposed to be banned. Ban him to the minors. I think that's kind of the issue, is that a lot of people, or the major league consensus seemed to be that Ruzne Castillo was not a major leaguer. I think the problem is there are probably other teams that want Yoshida's services, that believe he could be a productive member of their ball club, and they're just kind of waiting out the Red Sox right now, because the Red Sox did misplay their hand with Masataka Yoshida. And now they know that at some point the team is going to have to make a decision, and they may be able to get him for nothing. So if you pass him through waivers or you DFA him and you give another chance to claim him, then you're losing him for nothing. So I would have to imagine that they're not doing that, because they know that if you do try to pass him through waivers, he is going to get claimed, and then you don't get any value for a guy that does bring value. I mean, come on. I know that the Red Sox don't really value him all that highly. Is he an all-star? No. Is he still like a 260, 270 hitter that can bring you some pop from the left side and run into a few clutch hits every now and again? Yes, and I think that's the major league consensus and why they're trying to stash him right now. 609, Romy or Ref Snyder is a defensive improvement at first and a better bat based on Casas' last season. Get the kids some work in the minors at first. Fair point to say that if you want either one of the two kids in Meyer and Anthony to get some work, then those are the stopgaps. And I think that between Romy, Ref Snyder, and Abraham Toro, that's how they're going to bridge the gap. Maybe even David Hamilton. I'd imagine that's how they're going to bring the gap. But we're at the point where you need to have the conversation about a long-term solution. So that's kind of more where I've gone to. But if you're just looking at this to at least bridge the gap to the trade deadline, which Brian will get to in just a moment, then I can at least stomach the fact that you aren't losing that much from what you were getting in 2025. You can't move Yoshida like you did Ruzne anymore. Yes, I agree. 978, last one, then we'll get back to the conversation. I'm just concerned we have a 25 to 30 home run a year DH. I see no big value in that, which is where the conversation of try to get some more value out of Rafael Devers comes from, to try to get him to first. Okay, Brian, so We've talked about Romy. We've talked about Ref Snyder. We've talked about Story. For some reason, people want Bregman to move. I brought up Vaughn Grissom, who has played a little bit in the minors at first base. You have an internal solution and an external solution that intrigue me. What are they?
So my internal solution, I just did a little digging around, because I know, you know, when you're looking at positions in really any sport, measurables are a huge thing. We just went through it for 2-3 months with Will Campbell.
Yes.
And his short arms.
Too bad.
First baseman, you like them to be generally tall. So I looked up, how tall does a first baseman generally need to be? It said between 6'2 and 6'6. This is Go Big Recruiting, so take that what you will. GoBigRecruiting.com.
Well, I'll split it right down the middle. Freddie Freeman, Matt Olson, two of the better first basemen over the last 5-10 years, 6'4, right?
Perfect.
Down the middle.
So, according to Go Big Recruiting, as long as you're 6'2 and above, you're an ideal height to play first base. So, during one of the commercials, I asked you, hey, do you know how tall Christian Campbell is? And what did you tell me?
6'3".
6'3". So, to me, I've seen Campbell struggle at second base. I've seen him struggle in center field. I've seen him struggle at other positions that they try to throw him at. I don't understand why they haven't just tried to keep him at one position, whether that be second base, whether that be in the outfield, wherever they try to put him. Just put him somewhere and leave him there. So why not try to put him at first base? If you're going to move him around, you have a gaping hole at first base. Now, if you move him to first, we were talking about what we do with Trevor Story. Trevor Story doesn't have to go anywhere because I think he's a very good defensive shortstop.
Sure.
And now you have an excuse to call up Marcelo Meyer to go play third. Nobody moves to go play second.
Yeah.
I should say.
Stop moving Bregman, damn it.
I know. Sorry. Still had Devers on the mind.
Yeah.
You call up Marcelo Meyer. He can play second. Story can continue to play short. You slide Campbell over to first. And now it quiets the people like us who've been clamoring to bring up some of these younger players. You get one in, still have to figure out how to worm Roman Anthony into the lineup. But I think that's a good start. You sort of begin to see where you are with Marcelo Meyer. And I think it fills two needs because I think defensively, Meyer can't be much worse than what Christian Campbell's been at second base.
Right. Yeah. Well put. And I tell you what, Brian, that might be the favorite one that I've heard so far. Because the biggest complaint that...
Sick brag, bro.
Absolutely. Congratulations to you. Because the biggest complaint that I feel like we've seen and we've heard about Christian Campbell is the range and the ability to move laterally, make a play, and then be able to turn and throw accurately. So if you take a bit of the range out of the equation, but you still allow the natural athlete to be able to work on his agility and how quickly... All the stuff that we talked about at first base beforehand... I think there's a really interesting fit there. I really do. And the complaints have not necessarily been about his glove. It's just the glove when he's in motion and then his ability to throw when he's in motion. So if you take that out of the equation, he's a big target. You're giving up an inch between he and Tristan Casas. Casas is also 6'4", Campbell 6'3". Both right-handed, so it doesn't really change anything. I know the conventional wisdom is you want your first baseman to be a lefty, but none of these guys are lefties, so you kind of don't really have that option there either. And you committed to multiple right-handed first basemen the last couple years between Casas and then Dahlbeck before him. And Romy My Homie Gonzalez and Rob Refsnyder are also right-handed, so that's not changing. Height-wise, you're not changing. And you hit on maybe the most important point in all of this, which is clearly... You're not sold on Christian Campbell being your everyday second baseman or your everyday center fielder. There's clearly some lack of trust in his ability to hold down one position, at least in the infield. It seems like the whole center field thing, Brian, is a, well, if this doesn't work here, we still know he's a seems to be like a generational bat. But if he can't play second base, we've got to throw him somewhere because apparently we have this DH for the next 27 years.
And the issue, too, is they have so many outfielders. They have outfielders coming out of their nose. They already have three guys, and they're making it hard for Roman Anthony, who is a natural outfielder, to even play there.
Yes, yeah. And we're having conversations about sitting down a gold glove, potential platinum glove center fielder and say Don Rafaela just to get Roman Anthony into the mix. And that's not even including the fact that Christian Campbell is still in this conversation. And I know everybody already has Willier Abreu traded. Andy Hart would trade him for Mason Miller in a heartbeat. But he's still on your team, and he's pretty damn good, despite the fact that he's cooled off a little bit from hitting like 720 in the first couple weeks of the season. So all of that to say, of all the things that I have heard about this conversation, if you tell me that, say, come June 1st, or let's even say July 1st, my Red Sox lineup is Bregman, Story, Meyer, Campbell, Duran. No, I'm sorry. Anthony, Duran, Abreu, catching is a black hole no matter where you go, apparently. Narvaez, that's my catcher, by the way. Endeavors is your DH, and then that leaves your rotational players to be Romy My Homie or David Hamilton with Refsnyder and Sadon Rafaela, and then your backup catcher. That's a good ball club. And I tell you what, it's a good ball club in 2025. It's a better ball club in 2026. That is a straight up sick team in 2026, catcher notwithstanding. But just throw them ninth. You'll have eight hitters, and then whoever the hell you got to roll out there. I like that. I'm in on this. I am following Brian Fazoco to the promised land, to follow this Christian Campbell theory. You also brought up another external option.
Yeah, Rhys Hoskins. He's on his contract expires in 2026, so he's going to be a free agent. He had a down year last year with Milwaukee. This year he's, you know, off to a better start, hitting .266, has a few home runs. I sort of looked at this as he's proven he can play first base. He's played in big games with the Phillies, right? We've seen him in playoff series and playoff games hitting big home runs. And to me, you have a big gap as well as a power bat, a power righty bat in the middle of the order, right? I still just long-term don't have a lot of confidence in Trevor Story being able to make it through the season, and I know that's such a cop-out answer, but I really don't. I mean, I've seen too many injuries with him over the last few years.
Yeah, you're just basing it on evidence.
And I don't know if, even if he stays healthy, if he's going to be able to produce like he's produced, you know, to start the season. So to me, I also looked at a guy like Rhys Hoskins. Even if he's not going to hit for high average, even if he gets it, I mean, he's around 30 home runs just about every year that he's healthy. Even last year, in a year that he struggled, he had, just let me look really quickly, 27 home runs. And that was a bad year for him. I think he hit like .214.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I look at somebody like that where if you don't want to put Campbell there, or to your point, right, if you put Campbell there on June 1st, July 1st, and you get a month, 2 month sample size of Campbell, if you've already called up Roman Anthony, maybe you ship off one of your other prospects down in Worcester, whatever it is, try and go get a guy like that, because I don't think Milwaukee has any interest in paying him long term.
No, I think you're right. And they're 16 and 18 right now. So they're right in that precipice of like they'll be competitive versus not at the trade deadline. I look at their pitching, and they've already started Quinn Priester four times. He's pitched five times since they made that trade. The Red Sox, for some reason, didn't have him on his radar at all. So I don't look at that team having the kind of pitching that can sustain for 162 games. So I would not be surprised to see them on the outside of the picture looking in. And so that would make him that would make that a little bit more palatable. Okay, 617-779-7937. I see your calls. That was a long conversation on the first base position for the Red Sox. We will continue and wrap up the Red Sox conversation on the other side. We'll get to the Patriots, the Celtics, and the Bruins search for a head coach. All of that is on the table as we move on to the 11 o'clock
These
hour.
Days,
here on WEEI, and here's a commercial.
Nearly every corner.
Dan Ball on WEEI.
Don, just on the coaching search, do you have a timeline on that? And do you think it'd be necessary to have a coach in place when free agency starts?
Probably in a perfect world. Timing might be that the coaches that we identify are still part of the NHL playoffs. When you get permission, when's the appropriate time to get permission and opportunity, could present some challenges. I'll be forward thinking and communicating with that with certain people, but very respectful of their situations and what they're trying to accomplish. I don't have a definitive timeline, but my hope would be we'd be far along in, at that point in time.
All right, we're back with a banger here on WEEI just after 11 a.m. on Sunday, May the 4th. Alex Bregman took to Twitter to say, May the 4th be with you. So he's in on Star Wars Day. Hello to those joining here on WEEI as well as our affiliates in the Cape, Providence, Rhode Island, Springfield, Mass., Worcester, Mass., Portland, Maine, as well as Keene, New Hampshire, Claremont, New Hampshire, and White River Junction, Vermont. Dan Ball with you. If you're not listening on one of those fine stations, you're probably joining us on the Odyssey app. If you don't have it, you can download it free. You can get the replays and podcasts of all of our fantastic shows. Full slate coming up tomorrow. Greg Hill Show, Jones and Keefe, WEEI Afternoons, which may or may not hit on the Bill Belichick conversation. And surprise, surprise, here on this Sunday, I thought today was the Lord's Day and we'd finally get a break from the Belichick stuff. But that is not the case. There's been more, somehow, information that's come up on that situation, which we will get to in about 15 minutes' time here on WEEI. Cleaning up some of the texts, 573 advocates for the signing of Anthony Rizzo, which I don't necessarily mind. He certainly took a step back with the Yankees. He was dealing with some concussion issues, but good guy, would be kind of an interesting full circle moment. If you are, again, looking just for a short-term stopgap, you don't see the option at first base in the organization, that would be a guy who's good culture guy, high character guy. And if nothing else, he will probably barely hit his weight at this point, but he's not going to cost you at first base. Very good, sure-handed defensive first baseman in Anthony Rizzo. And the last one, bring in Justin Turner with five question marks from the 401. He's hitting a .167 at age 40.
People really
Chicago
fell
Cubs.
In love with Justin Turner that one year he was here.
I think that's twofold. I think he earned it. He seemed to be a good guy, like a good clubhouse guy. The guys looked at him as a leader. But again, that was the year where it was like, oh, our leadership group is Justin Turner and Rob Refsnyder because we literally have no other veterans on this roster a couple years ago. It was more, and this is going to be too negative towards Turner, but it was more of just an indictment on the state of the roster that people fell in love with him. But he's had a down year this year. He's a rotational player for the Chicago Cubs. He was a 264 hitter last year. So if you think you could salvage something, maybe you watch. I wouldn't be totally surprised to see him DFA'd at some point if those numbers continue to hold. But I'd like it. Again, those are all short-term solution kind of conversations that we are having. I'm taking a quick pause from the in between the Red Sox and then getting to the New England Patriots and some of the Bill drama on top of the actual current-day Patriots and their offseason productivity to address the Boston Bruins, because Mike Sullivan, former head coach of the New York Rangers, longtime previous head coach of the Boston Bruins, Marshfield, Massachusetts native, and Charlie McAvoy's father-in-law, signed the richest contract for a coach in NHL history. Sullivan's deal, 5 years, will make him the highest paid coach in league history, sources told ESPN's Emily Kaplan. He signs with the New York Rangers just days after being let go after a long stint and a couple of Stanley Cups with the Pittsburgh Penguins. So Sullivan, who was automatically at the top of a lot of teams' boards who are looking to solve their head coaching vacancies, is now off the board. So you're competing with right now the Anaheim Ducks, the Chicago Blackhawks, the Philadelphia Flyers, the Pittsburgh Penguins, who just let Sullivan go, the Seattle Kraken, and the Vancouver Canucks. So right now there are seven teams, including you, that are trying to fill their head coaching role. Who are the names that are still available to the Boston Bruins? The one that was at the top of my list, though I don't think it's going to be overly realistic anymore, I have not heard anything in terms of actual connections, is 35-year-old David Carl, head coach at Denver, one of the best college coaches in the nation right now, has at least one national championship under his belt, has coached internationally with Team USA at the World Juniors for a number of years, actually recently just announced that he's not going to be doing it anymore, but had been doing it for the last couple of years. He is an up and coming name that I think every single team in hockey is going to at least be intrigued by. But it seems like he is being very, very picky, as is his right, as we talk about guys in like crossing sports for a moment, like a Ben Johnson in the NFL. That's the kind of pedigree it seems like David Carl has as the up and coming next head coach. Now, he doesn't have professional experience, but when you're talking about guys that are coming from the collegiate ranks, he's a guy whose resume is ironclad. He pulled his name out of the proceedings with the Chicago Blackhawks, and I haven't really heard him outright connected to the Boston Bruins. And it seems like the conventional wisdom is he's going to return to Denver, because the teams that are available to him to sign, the Anaheim Ducks, perpetually a bottom five team in the league. The Philadelphia Flyers, a lot of money, just fired John Tortorella, big time mess. Pittsburgh Penguins, very clearly entering a rebuild. Seattle Kraken, just don't have the star power to be a consistent playoff contender. And Vancouver, Vancouver's the best group out of all of those. But again, you are that's a Canadian market. He is an American guy. And that may not be the right fit. And that's also a group that's kind of in a weird middle ground. They have a lot of talent. They pay a lot of money, but they're a good team. They just haven't been able to put it all together. And then there's the Bruins. Legacy franchise, original six franchise. Bit of a mess at the moment. So unless you're willing to pay what the Rangers did, which the pejorative term that's thrown around in these situations is the suck tax. Unless you're willing to pay David Carl the suck tax, you're probably not going to lure him away from Denver, as you are in the midst of a rebuild yourself. So what else does that leave you? A couple options that I've seen thrown around. Jay Woodcroft, which might be my leader in the clubhouse right now, former head coach of the Edmonton Oilers. He took over the Oilers in 2021-22, had a 26-9-3 record, lost in the conference finals to Colorado. Then a full season in 22-23, 50-23-9, second in the Pacific, lost in the second round to the Vegas Golden Knights. His team started 3-9-1 in the 23-24 season, and he was let go. Has not been coaching since then. good resume, worked as an assistant coach of the Canadian team at the 2024 IIHF World Championship, so he's still very much in the mix. Good resume as an assistant coach, making his way up through the ranks. But Woodcroft is a name that's on people's radars. I wouldn't mind that. Rick Tocchet, who was let go by Vancouver, you got a little bit of the new coach bump with Vancouver under Tocchet. I think that if you need a coach who's going to bring accountability, who's going to kind of bring the fight to the players, and you kind of see that being your biggest need, culture versus development, Tocchet has a resume for that. A guy who I'm intrigued by, he was on the Bruins staff previously, is Jay Pandolfo as well, since going to his alma mater at Boston University. 29-11, Frozen Four. 28-10-2, Frozen Four. 24-14-2, NCAA runner-up. Very good resume as the head coach of BU, but again, maybe that's where he wants to stay. If he looks at the Jack Parker kind of legacy that you can leave at a tremendous hockey school in Boston University, maybe that's exactly where he wants to stay. And I would not blame him for that. So you're probably going to have to be comfortable making a hire that may not necessarily be the long-term coach. What I would be favoring right now is a guy who you know can develop versus a guy who can elevate to a championship level, if that makes sense. Now, the offseason moves the Bruins make could change that conversation, but you're in a rebuild right now. You are trying to squeeze what you can out of Fraser Minton, Matt Patra, Fabian Lysell, Mason Lauri, these young guys who you've drafted who, again, haven't amounted to all that much yet or traded for in Minton's case. You're trying to get a lot out of your younger players to try to pair them with the few pillars that you have remaining, which is David Pastrnak and Charlie McAvoy. So questions still abound, and if I'm a free agent head coach, if I'm the top of the class in the NHL, I look at that Bruins situation and I look at their leadership group, and I'm not overly high on joining this group right now. This is a pivotal, crucial, franchise direction defining kind of offseason that you have. If you're going through the full rebuild where you are valuing your draft picks and you really are bringing in 18-year-olds and maybe sending them back to college or sending them back to the juniors or back to juniors and understanding that your window to start to compete is maybe another year or two away, I'm going to trust Don Sweeney and Cam Neely's draft record to do it right? The answer to me would be no. If, however, the sales pitch to whoever you're going to hire is these draft picks are not going to be ours much longer. We're making trades. We're trying to move around the draft board. We're trying to bring in NHL-ready talent now. We're going to be active in free agency. And this team is going to look different, but it's going to be competitive right away. Well, then maybe you'll have a better chance to bring in somebody who's worth their salt.
Not to mention mentioning to the new coach when you do hire him, you're not going to be the scapegoat this time.
Yeah.
So Sweeney and Neely can keep their jobs like we've done with the last four or five coaches.
Yes, exactly. And that's a huge point of it, because even if I'm told that, like, hey, man, we believe in you, you're going to be the one that changes the tide. Why would I believe that? Because
the Bruins inevitably choke, yes, you're going to be the one who gets blamed for it.
100%. Because what I took away from that end of season press conference, and I'm glad you brought this up, what I took away from that is that Charlie Jacobs and the Jacobs family, they have invested financially in the Bruins, but it doesn't really seem like they have a lot of hands-on day-to-day understanding of what's going on. So they have entrusted Cam Neely, who seems to have a lifetime contract, to run the entire kit and caboodle. And regardless of what's gone on with this team, it's not Neely's fault, because Neely was the one who answered the question addressing Don Sweeney's contract situation. So Neely will decide if Don Sweeney is about to be the scapegoat in a year's time. And Sweeney is kind of just the puppet, not the puppeteer, is the feeling that I got watching the order and who answered what questions about what for the Boston Bruins. So Neely's the one guy that's bridged all these gaps. From the Claude Julien, Peter Chiarelli, through the the Bruce Cassidy into the Jim Montgomery, into Sweeney, now into Joe Sacco, all those scapegoats, all those blaming and finger pointing and losing veterans and not drafting well, and the things over the last decade that have gotten you to this point where we are having this conversation on May the 4th, 2025, and the playoffs are going on and your playoff hopes are months in the rearview mirror. Neely's that guy that bridges that entire gap. And yet it does. It seems like he is the safest person in the organization and maybe the safest person in Boston. I did not get the sense that he has any kind of pressure on him to try to make this work in 2025, 26, or, you know, or he's gone. Let's take a call before we get to Brian's trending, and let's take it from Jake in Boston. Good morning, Jake. How are you?
Morning. Listen, I hate to break it to you. Your David Carl fantasy is not happening as long as Don Sweeney and Cam Neely are in the building. You got to remember, Carl got his start under Jim Montgomery at the University of Denver. They're very close.
Yep.
Monty left here under bad terms. He has not been shy about that. They have talked. He will not come here unless Don and Cam are gone. And I want him here, too. So if you want that move, what you're really looking for is you're looking for a bridge year. You're looking for the top two to be blown out the door. You're also looking at trying to bring in a team president slash general manager like Ryan Bonus, who's the assistant GM in Ottawa, who plucked Omar from out under you this past season and rebuilt faster than a lot of teams did. Bonus does have a relationship with Carl and could get that done. You also are at this crossroads in two ways. One is Gavin McKenna is the next generational talent that I would not mind completely tanking, going for a number one pick for in 2026. If you half-heartedly do this rebuild, you lose out on that opportunity. You might as well keep Sacco here under that circumstance. Or just if you think Carl Bonus could be the solution, just give me the red meat. Peter Laviolette, John Tortorella, both are from here. Tortorella can have guys blocking a bunch of shots. You'll get a conflict with Pasternak that'll force a trade, which will continue to force your rebuild. The half-hearted rebuild from the always come up short 1990s Bruins core is not going to do it for you.
Well put, Jake, on all fronts. Thanks for the call. And that's good extra information about David Carl that I had forgotten about, so I appreciate that. And the overall point that he illustrated in a couple of different ways about are you keeping this front office structure for the Bruins or not is the million-dollar question that it doesn't seem like, and this goes back to the end of your press conference, doesn't seem like the Jacobs family is willing to have with both Cam Neely and Don Sweeney. And that's where I think this issue arises from more than anything else. Would I have advocated for a clean sweep of the organization under the ownership this year? Abso-freaking-lutely. And I think you could have justified it in the previous year or years, but you got just enough out of your hired guns and your trade deadline acquisitions and moving draft picks and suspending the inevitable where, all right, fine, Sweeney gets another year. Fine, Neely gets another year. This is the year that was your chance to make those organizational changes to finally say the old guard is no longer in touch with what's going on in today's NHL. And that's my biggest problem is the drafting, the draft habits, the free agent habits, the trading habits, the roster building habits of the Neely Sweeney regime were working in the early to mid 2010s because you could still build your roster to win a championship based on grit and tenacity and will outscore everybody 2-1 with a good goalie. That is not the way the NHL is built. That is not the way NHL prospects are going. And that is not a skill set that I believe the Neely Sweeney regime has. I don't think they have the ability to recognize the players that you need to be successful in 2025 and beyond in the NHL. So this was the year, if the Jacobs overarching view, if they recognize that, this was the year to make that change. So now you have draft assets and cap space for the first time in years, and you're trusting this group to try to identify players that I just don't think they have the sheer ability to identify. So if you were going to make that change to then try to entice the head coach that will actually be here to develop and grow with a young core of players, you needed to make those changes from the top down. Instead, I have a longstanding duo in my front office that seem to have job security that has not been earned in recent years. And I'm going to sign up as my coach in David Carl's case. And Jake, thank you again for the call because you brought up a number of good points. My first resume item is going to be joining a not lame duck, but certainly a questionable front office that has made a scapegoat out of multiple high-level coaches that have legitimately gone on to championship-caliber seasons in the years directly following coaching the Bruins, my first choice is going to be signing myself up for that. So it's points all well taken, and it unfortunately gives me pause for how much I believe in where this thing is going in the near future for the Bruins. 617-779-7937. From one coach, and I guess former coaches, to another. Unfortunately, I was planning and I had my document set up to do no Bill Belichick today. We got into the gossip TMZ sourced page six nonsense over the last week here on the station and specifically on WEEI Afternoons, and it was fun. But it's something that I was hoping to be able to purge from my system. I am not, however, doing my due diligence if we don't get to this story about the latest development and the Belichick-Jordan relationship, both professionally and personally. We'll get to that after Brian Frazoco tells you what's trending. To run the entire kit and caboodle, abso-freaking-lutely.
Now, here's what's trending on WEEI.
Yes, here is what's trending on WEI and on WEI.com. The Red Sox dropped Game 2 of their three-game weekend set against the Minnesota Twins yesterday at Fenway Park 4-3. Game 3 of that series is today with first pitch at 1:35 on the Shaw's and Star Market WEI Red Sox Radio Network with Will Fleming and Mike Monaco on the call. Garrett Crochet will be on the bump for the Red Sox. You got Chris Paddock on the hill for the Twins. And the MassMutual pregame show will begin at 12:35 right here with Joe Weil. The Denver Nuggets advance to the second round of the playoffs after beating the Clippers 120-101 yesterday in Game 7. They will now take on the Thunder in Round 2. James Harden was only able to score 7 points. The final game of the first round is tonight with the Golden State Warriors in Houston to take on the Rockets for Game 7. The winner of that game will take on the Minnesota Timberwolves. The second round also tips off today with the Pacers in Cleveland to take on the Cavaliers. And the Celtics kick off their second round series against the Knicks tomorrow with tip-off at 1 o'clock. Tip-off of Game 1 at 7 o'clock from TD Garden. In hockey news, the Dallas Stars took down the Avalanche in Game 7 last night behind a hat-trick from Mikko Rantanen. The final game of the quarterfinals for the NHL is tonight, with Jim Montgomery and the St. Louis Blues in Winnipeg to take on the Jets. The away team has yet to win a game in that series. The NHL draft lottery is tomorrow night. The Bruins currently have the 6th highest odds to land the number 1 overall pick. And Sovereignty was a Kentucky Derby winner yesterday. He won with 7-1 odds going in. I'm Brian Frazoco. That's what's trending on WEI and on WEI.com.
Dan Ball on WEI.
Sir, this order will make it socially acceptable for a man in his 70s to date a 24-year-old.
That's right. We're calling it the Belichick Law. We're going to make girlfriends young again, okay? Old men can now date far younger women. We like that. It's hot. But in reverse, it's quite disgusting, right? Very Dateline, you know?
That was from last night's Saturday Night Live. So added to the long list of every publication that you can find making fun of arguably the greatest head coach in NFL history, at least, you know, a top five, if you were putting together Mount Rushmore of best coaches in football. And all of that, I could list you out the resume items until I'm blue in the face for what he did at the NFL level. And none of that matters to people right now. It doesn't matter, but it also informs why we're having this discussion. And we're back here on WEEI, Dan Ball with you just after 11:30 here on May the 4th, 2025. About an hour until we get you into coverage of the Boston Red Sox. My man Joe Weil is down at the Fenway Ford Clubhouse Studios. So we'll catch up with him very briefly in the final segment here before we get into pregame coverage, and then he'll have you. 12:35, 1:35 is your first pitch with Will and Mike Monaco on the broadcast today. I mention it, and I hand to God promise you that this was not in my personal rundown for where we were going on today's show.
I can attest to that. It was not. We talked pre-show.
Yeah.
You said no Belichick today.
And I kind of like, I tried to present it as dismissive when I was talking to you because I was honest about, that's honestly how I felt. I'm like, all right, I've heard enough. I heard the R. Kelly rendition from KJ. And if anything made me not want to talk about it more, it was that. So that brings me to this. This is Pro Football Talk 928 this morning. So I saw it floating around Twitter during a break. I'm like, all right, let's at least get to this, and maybe this will give us some hope for the future. Bill Belichick seems to know that his current publicity plan isn't working. This is directly from Mike Florio earlier today. And whatever you believe for the source, I'm just reading it based on what it's presenting that so you can inform your own opinion. Per multiple sources, Belichick has been talking to at least one experienced PR specialist in the hopes of boosting his book tour and or the overall interests of the North Carolina football program. Belichick has been having conversations with former Bears VP of Communications, Brandon Faber. The discussions have been occurring for a couple of months. For now, however, nothing has been completed or formalized. The potential assignment encompasses working directly for North Carolina and or assisting Belichick with non-UNC matters like his book. It would be wise for Belichick to get someone to provide him with frank, candid advice on how to navigate the media. As it relates to his book tour, Belichick has badly blown it by assuming the media needs him more than he needs the media. The decision to revert to that goofy, truculent press conference presence did him no favors during his recent CBS interview. Throw in his girlfriend, serving as a de facto umpire who regarded oversized softballs as high heat, and it was all even more bizarre. So the crux of the conversation is that Belichick has not started, but has rather consistently been in contact with Brandon Faber, former Bears vice president of communications. Notice the resume item that I list. Bears, like Chicago Bears, like Brian Frazoco's favorite team.
That's not the team you want to seek advice from. Let me just firsthand experience.
I knew you were going there with that. But look, it's somebody who has been around the block at the professional level. And it just adds another wrinkle into what is just one of the most bizarre falls from grace that I remember seeing of somebody at this high on the ladder of professional sports accomplishments that I've seen in a very long time, if not ever. What kind of makes me, I guess, a little confused about this note, before I continue, go ahead, Brian.
No, I was going to say, so this whole story is about Bill Belichick reaching out for outside help,
yes.
Right? Outside
help. Yeah.
You know, that kind of reminds me of something.
Mac Jones wasn't happy. He was telling people he wasn't happy. He was calling people about, hey, can you help us with ideas and do stuff like that? Right? From my understanding, Belichick found out all these things. He found out that Mac was talking to people and all this. And there was some, you know, back channel, you know, conversations going on behind Belichick's back.
Okay. Huh. All right. So it's a pot kettle situation we have.
Well, it's just sort of funny when Belichick wouldn't even refer to his quarterback by his first name for an entire year because he was reaching out and trying to get support when Belichick hired two nincompoops to run the offense and the quarterback didn't want to trust him. He gets mad at that. But when he goes behind his girlfriend's back to go seek PR, no, that's fine. Okay, yeah. I just wanted to clear that up.
Well, yeah, of course. The rules clearly do not apply to Bill in this situation or seemingly many others. And if you don't believe me, wait till, I guess, Tuesday at 3 o'clock when Ted Johnson joins in on WEEI Afternoons. So I say I bring all of that to the front. And Brian, thank you for bringing that up because that is very strangely appropriate in this conversation. He's been having conversations with this gentleman. They've been going on for a couple of months. Nothing has been completed or formalized. So my question is, was Brandon Faber, this name that now just comes up out of nowhere, was he at all aware of what was about to go down on this CBS interview that set the world on fire? Or has he been consulted or aware in any way, shape, or form about the social media antics that are going on between Bill and Jordan right now? And by the way, for anybody that doesn't like the Jordan and just wants to call her Jordan, her name's Jordan. Her Instagram name is capital J, lowercase O-R-D, capital O, lowercase N, Jordan. That's how I'm supposed to say it. That's the pronunciation guide for how I'm supposed to say her name. So I digress from there. So is he aware, has he been consulted
on all of the things that have built up to where this conversation finds itself today. The beach pose and the Atlanta Falcons 28-3 t-shirts and the, you know, the ripped up Navy sweatshirt and the overall presence and feel of the interview and the released email statement that we or the released email allegedly from Bill that we got this week. And then the statement from UNC. I tell you what, if he is truly a PR professional, I would hope and wonder if Brandon Faber was involved in the UNC statement. But then again, that also really missed the mark. Because the statement that came out tried to kind of falsify the way that CBS put together that book interview. And then CBS responded back with like a tweet. And they said, no, we had confirmation before and after that we have the creative license to turn this interview how we please. And they did. And noticed that there was no shot back across the bow from anybody involved in UNC. So I don't know who this guy is, and I don't know why his name is being mentioned now, because this is not the time to say that you've been consulting with Belichick for the last couple months. Because the last couple months, he himself, with the help of his lovely creative muse, Jordan, has completely taken away from his resume as a football coach. And more importantly, to where we are in 2025, has made a lot of people question his ability to lead the UNC football program.
And it's like, if you bring up Bill Belichick right now, you don't think about anything having to do with football. At least with Brady, and Brady's doing a million things. They had the whole roast about him last year, as you remember, and they're making fun of him for everything not having to do with football. But when you hear Tom Brady, you still think football, you still think Super Bowl, 7-time Super Bowl winner. With Belichick, now it's just completely shifted in the other direction. Half the time I forget that he's the head coach of North Carolina, because it's everything is just shifted and focused into his relationship.
And if I was a recruit, if I was a transfer, if I was a donor, if I was anybody attached to that program, I would agree with you and be extremely concerned for, well, how the hell are you supposed to then get a competent team on the field? And I trust that you can get the best out of them when September comes around. I thought that's what this was all supposed to be about. When he took this job, it was supposed to be, we're really excited about getting into college football. We think the NFL, this is what Mike Lombardi said to McAfee, we think the NFL has lost its way, and we're really excited to be where we are right now and try to bring greatness back to a program that he has ties to. His dad was involved in the UNC program a half century ago, and so I thought that's what this was supposed to be about. And Brian brings up a good point. When I think about Tom Brady, I think about the greatest quarterback of all time, a winner as a football player, and now a media mogul, a face, a continued face of football, but in a different light, accepting what his current life is going to be. Okay? Accepting that I'm not a player. I have moved into my role as an executive. I am a broadcaster. I'm an influencer. I'm still a celebrity, but my resume as a football player is allowing me to do these extracurriculars after my career, and I'm okay with that. That's what I think about with Brady. When I think about Belichick at this point, what I see is a guy who was unequivocally a fantastic football coach, good, great football coach, had great players helping him build dynasties. And I look at him now as a guy who is trying to hold on to something, trying to hold on to his prime and his youth, and trying to create a narrative in the media and dictate how people should feel about me, that I'm still an incredible coach. I'm still a stud. People love me. Look at my girlfriend. Look at my book. Look at my UNC program. I don't need the NFL. I'm going to continue to try to do this at the collegiate level, and I'm still the same old Bill. No, you're not. It's a really bizarre, weird, kind of sad state of affairs. It's sad. I genuinely am starting to feel sad for one of the greatest coaches in NFL and professional sports history. resume-wise, pedigree-wise, football knowledge, especially on defense-wise. But once that shine and the shimmer of the post-Brady years started to come along, all of a sudden, Brian, the decision-making started to get a little questionable, and you brought it up. Hiring Joe Judge and moving Matt Patricia onto the offense and drafting a quarterback, but then not trusting or liking the quarterback and not knowing how to parse through a quarterback competition, and the fact that your backup was playing well and your starter was feeling threatened. These football decisions were highly questionable.
Well, can I argue that he sort of always had these questionable decisions? It's just he had the quarterback to kind of cover up for some of these mistakes, whether it's not letting Gostkowski kick the field goal in Super Bowl 42, whether it's benching Malcolm Butler in Super Bowl, whatever that was, 52, off the top of my head, the Eagles Super Bowl, where he benched Malcolm Butler. 4th-and-2 in 2009 against the Colts. Like, he always sort of had all of these questionable decisions.
So let me ask you a question based on that. I want to see where you feel on this. So are these personal life decisions for you personally? This is not, you know, Patriots fans, anything for you personally. Are these personal life decisions shining a different light or a more negative light on his coaching resume and his ability, like the decision making that he made as the coach of the New England Patriots?
I don't think there's a lot of people who view this as a positive for him, no matter which way you look at it. So, you know, in terms of what you're asking me, I would say no. I mean, I think a lot of people are now looking at him as a whole and questioning his decision making, to your question, right?
Yes.
In general, right? And I think a lot of people are now focusing on just the negatives about Bill Belichick. So whether that be the Jordan Hudson relationship, whether that be football decisions, whether it just be what he's doing at UNC and what he's doing in his personal life, I think people are sort of just questioning everything. And I think we, you know, both of us lived it growing up in New England. There was a time where even if the Patriots lost, Patriots fans would call into sports talk radio shows that you and I would listen to and say, well, yeah, he meant to lose it. It's part of a bigger plan. Belichick could do no wrong in the eyes of so many people.
Yeah.
We work with a guy every day in Stiz Grimey who I think is finally sort of starting to turn the other way. But for 25 years, Stiz would not believe that Bill Belichick could do anything wrong.
Yeah.
And this is even turning him.
Yes. Well put. Well put across the board. Yeah, it's people are questioning their faith. A faith that was unshakable for years and years and years and years. You're right about that. So well put across the board. We have text to catch up on. I see Joe on the line. We got a couple other calls that we'll get to as well. I know this is salacious. I know this is an X's and O's in terms of sports. But this is a pillar Mount Rushmore figure in Boston sports that is going through not only an identity crisis, but also a change in reputation, a change in legacy, I would argue, and just a really bizarre and sad state of affairs in his post-Patriots career. So I think it's just, it's a conversation we didn't think we were going to be having, but I want to continue having it. We'll take your calls. We'll get to your text right after this.
Dan Ball on WEEI.
1992, Bill and I were on this campus. We were scouting. We were living in Cleveland at the time. Dark winters, cold rain, you know how it goes, and we needed to get south. We came to Chapel Hill, and we stayed over at the Carolina Inn, this really magnificent hotel on campus. And we thought, how in the hell can't you win here? And that's been in our minds ever since. And I think, to me, this is a magical place that has had great players. Lawrence Taylor, you know, Julius Peppers, some incredibly great players. We need to build great teams.
That was Michael Lombardi on McAfee a couple months ago, right after Bill Belichick was hired, painting his version of reality after Belichick was hired, about why they were so excited to finally leave the NFL behind, the burdens, break free from the chains of professional football, really, and get down to Chapel Bill. The text line has been making me laugh out loud on this, so I'll read through a couple of those, then we'll get to a call. One that agrees and one that does not. So we'll get the duality of this situation The new Bill scandal, Jordan Gate. I'm going to start using that. The real hypocrisy is the fact that he used to always get mad when players would say anything in the media that we create a distraction from football. Now that's all he does. Very true. The hypocrisy here is tremendous. I'm actually shocked that an intelligent person like Bill has not understood transfer of skills into a new beginning. It shows me how stale and antiquated he really is. The old shtick is not working. Fair point. Legacy impacted. Greatest coach of all time who was loaded and has mansions on Nantucket and is doing something, a word that I cannot read on the radio. A hot 24-year-old. I'd love 1/8 of that legacy. Yeah, I agree. But again, this is, we're talking about where he came from to where he is right now, and how when people look back at the overarching thing, the 30,000-foot view of Bill Belichick, what are we going to talk about? Great coach, really kind of don't love it, kind of end to the whole thing. Last one from the 603 before we get to the calls. You think Bill will let Jordan go to free agency when her rookie contract is up, which is my favorite of the lot. And the answer to that question is yes. All right, let's go. I know we got to get to a break, so we'll do one right now. Will is in the truck. He disagrees. Good morning, Will. What do you got?
Well, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, if you can take a step outside the media world,
sure.
Some of this, you know, are we saying salacious? I don't know. Are we saying scandalous? It doesn't feel like it. I mean, I opened up the news this morning and there was a freshman football recruit from Texas who was on his way to the strip club with recruits and he was drunk and he was high. Like, that's a scandal. That's what's not being a good coach. This is about an old guy kind of hanging out with a younger one. It might be creepy. You know, there may be some parts to that, but I'm not willing to bury him. But on the media side,
yeah,
you could see where skeptics might say, boy, this, you guys have been waiting for this for 25 years because this is the boss that told you to sit down and shut up for 25 years. And now you can put a knife in his back. And that's what it feels like from the media side.
Thank you for the call, Will. That's an interesting point. And I can't sit here and say that I was part of the Patriots beat. I work with people who have covered the Patriots in many different capacities and a guy who played for the Patriots. So I can't, from my own personal experience, say like, oh, I've been waiting for the Belichick downfall for years. I think that's an interesting element to all of this, is the perspectives of the people who are covering it. And, you know, some of it's on record, how people feel if they've had interaction, good, bad, or otherwise, with this guy. I can't speak to that, so that's not where my opinions on all of this are coming, but I think it's worth keeping in mind when you hear the commentary about it, if that makes sense. Who's it coming from? What's the background? Do they have any other extra ground? All I can do before we go to break and get into the 12 o'clock hour is tell you where I'm coming from. I would not consider this to be a scandal either, compared to, you know, whatever, Spygate, Deflategate. I know the thing on the text line said Jordan Gate. That's very funny. It's not a scandal. Yes, there are some details of this that are pushing the limits of some statutes that are available in this country, but
very Dateline, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's all it is. It's salacious. It's gossip. That's what this is. Like, it's entertainment. KJ kind of put it that way. It's entertainment. It's kind of a version of a car crash. Like, you want to look away, but you just can't because of the personality, the person, the professional, the resume, the championships, all of the stuff that comes along with the enigma that is Bill Belichick. All of that comes into play when you talk about the relationship, the personal relationship, which is already a little bizarre. If it was just a personal relationship, we'd go, oh, that's kind of weird. And you know how much we talk about it? That much. It'd be done. It's the fact that the personal relationship is impacting the professional relationship, which is now impacting his media presence and is clearly a factor in his attempt to build the championship caliber program at UNC. That's why we're talking about this. It isn't a scandal. It's certainly a topic for discussion.
But in reverse, it's quite disgusting, right?
Yeah, it is. And that's it. Like, let's be honest. It makes your skin crawl a little bit. Just a little bit. And maybe some people more than others. And maybe some people aren't bothered by it at all. His life, his choices, I'm happy for him. I think they're a version of happy, potentially. I don't know. It's just the whole thing is so odd. And now why we're talking about it is because it seems like it's going to have an impact. It may have an impact on the football field. And we'll certainly see if that ends up being the case. Okay. We shall all remove ourselves from our moral soapboxes and get back to the Boston Red Sox because they play a rubber game against the Minnesota Twins this afternoon. We'll get you ready for that. We'll chat with Joe Weil in just a couple of moments as well. He's got your pregame coverage. Will Fleming and Mike Monaco have the call. We move into the 12 o'clock hour on a beautiful Sunday here on WEEI.
Very Dateline, you know?